I have signed on a board quite a few times and been at the helm of fundraisers.
Because you have a big heart.
Oh, I'm a sucker. I'm the one that
shows
up. She
can't say no.
And nobody else shows up at the meeting. That's what I learned. Oh. And then you're put in charge.
Hello, everyone. It's the Two Boomer Babes.
Do you ever wonder what's considered normal behavior for happy couples?
We'll take a peek behind the relationship curtain to reveal some secrets.
Then, how to get volunteers to say yes and keep them happy and motivated. A leadership guru tells all.
Plus, we're all for aging gracefully, but sometimes we need a little help. A plastic surgeon shares the latest cosmetic procedures.
And we'll shoot the breeze about medicinal must-have spices for your next adventure.
When it comes to love, sex, and marriage, are you curious about what normal is? And perhaps more importantly, how the normal in your relationship stacks up against other couples? If we could take a peek into the lives of those that say they're happy, we want to know, what are their secrets for remaining deeply connected and passionate despite the heavy demands of everyday life?
Wellness entrepreneur Chrisanna Northrup and sociologist Dr. James Witte and Dr. Pepper Schwartz decided to find out. They polled nearly 100,000 people around the world, the most extensive survey of romantic relationships ever conducted. The results are revealed in their book, The Normal Bar, The Surprising Secrets of Happy Couples and What They Reveal About Creating a New Normal in Your Relationship. Dr. Pepper Schwartz, AARP's relationship expert, joins us on the phone from Seattle. Welcome to the program, Pepper.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to talk to you.
Now, who are the people that actually participated in the survey? Were there lots of boomers involved?
We had probably near 80,000 now of people in 10 countries in the United States, and there were a lot of boomers. We think that people who participated, they were very diverse by color, by religion, by age, by duration of relationship, but they were all people who were interested in relationships. It was on more than 5 internet sites, and some of them were ones that boomers would be likely to go to. They were on AOL, Huffington Post, Reader's Digest, iVillage, AARP, so we got a lot of boomers.
The majority of people that you surveyed seemed happy in their relationship. I think it was about 3/4 or 74%.
Yeah.
But that number seemed kind of high considering the 50% divorce rate. So how do you reconcile those two figures?
It may well be that in this study, which is not a random sample, if you're really in the throes of a relationship that's going down the tubes, you may be a little less likely to want to fill out a questionnaire like this. I think we did talk to more happy people than not, but I'd say we had a consistent 20-25% people who were unhappy. So we could look at unhappy couples, even if it didn't represent the universe of all couples. And remember, in any given year, it's not necessarily 50% of people that are getting divorced.
And Pepper, is there any way to know through the survey or through statistics that if people were really telling the truth or not, or if they were embellishing a little bit?
People lie to themselves. So, you know, we can hardly expect a straight answer. But I think the law of large numbers and the consistency of responses are the ones that make you think you've got a real answer. You know, this is an unusual questionnaire in the sense that every so often you took it, you would find out how you were looking compared to other people. It would automatically tell you. So we think that most people are actually honest searchers, and they're not trying to impress us. I mean, after all, who are we? And it's anonymous.
So what's normal in a relationship? I'm sitting on the edge of my chair.
Remember, there's no 98.6 normal in relationships. We wanted to see what is the normal way people conduct themselves. We looked at all kinds of couples, but we centered on the ones that were extremely happy. And what we found were some interesting things about affection, romance, sexuality, trust. For example, what was normal for extremely happy couples was a lot of affectionate and romantic behaviors, saying I love you every day, cuddling most of the time, having pet names for each other. 75% or so of couples who were extremely happy called each other honey, dear, sweetheart, things like that. Spontaneously kissing, giving each other gifts. I mean, they're the normal of extremely happy relationship is showing a lot of romance and affection. So only 12% of our extremely happy couples did not go on a date night, as opposed to a very very large percentage of people who said they were doing okay but didn't describe themselves as extremely happy. Almost all of them had taken a romantic vacation. 75% of our other couples had never taken a vacation away from their kids.
Wow, that's surprising.
Well, yeah, it was surprising.
Yeah.
So those are the kinds of things we looked at. What's the normal that makes you happy? What are the things that reinforce you being very happy? And what's going on at every age group, every duration, all kinds of situations to see the normal when things aren't going so well?
Now, Pepper, when I was reading your book, I kind of skipped to this chapter about sex and relationships, so we got to cut to the chase here.
Oh, naughty girl.
I know. So how important did you find that sex was in a relationship?
It's very important. If anybody thinks they can back burner it, think again. Our extremely happy couples, now I know you'll find this daunting when, and obviously it's not the same number for boomers, but our extremely happy couples over all the ages were having sex 3 to 4 times a week. And our extremely happy boomers were more like a couple times a week. But they're having a lot of sex. It reinforces the relationship. It creates intimacy. I tell you, Italians of any age were having, 2/3 of all Italians, because of course this was in many countries we did this, were having sex 3 to 4 times a week. So
those Italians.
I know. Everybody's going to go out and get their plane ticket. But I really do think that sexuality is not something, even as you get older, even as boomers, that you can afford to put away. One of the things we found is that a very large number of men, and more men than women, say that not only is they missing romance, but that it bothers them a lot. Women miss it too, but it doesn't bother them as much. And where do men get their romance? Sexuality and romance to them are extremely tied together.
We're talking with sociologist Dr. Pepper Schwartz about what constitutes normal behavior among happy couples and the steps we can take to establish a new normal. Pepper is AARP's relationship expert and co-author of The Normal Bar. So, Pepper, we were talking about sex in a marriage. Now, you hear so much about these sexless marriages. What did you find?
There are about 1/4 of people in our sample who rarely or never have sex. And we found in the boomers that about 20% of our boomers did not have sex anymore and actually could still be happy. So 20% of people don't have sex and they still have a happy relationship, but 80% of them, do have sex and it is correlated with being extremely happy. So yes, there are circumstances where sex doesn't, isn't the big thing. People, as they get older, they have knee problems, they have heart problems, they have diabetes, they have a lot of stuff that the medications they take make it difficult for them to be aroused or interested. They may be frail. I mean, there are things where survival is more important than sexuality. I'm not saying it's the be and end all. But for the vast majority of extremely happy couples as boomers, they did have sex.
Did you discover anything that helps to rev up a tired sex life?
Well, I talked about in the beginning about all these affectionate behaviors. Holding hands was extremely important and was a connection to people that lowered their, we know that it lowers cholesterol and stress, that it makes people more able to connect. I think spending time away, going to someplace new, traveling, having a little date, wooing each other, all those affectionate romantic behaviors. I think sometimes people get so casual with each other and they think, oh, we know each other. We've been in the bathroom together. They forget to dress up, to hold hands, to cuddle, to kiss, to spontaneously say, I love you, to court each other a little bit. And those are the kinds of behaviors that put people in the mood and see each other differently. One of the things we looked at was how often couples stop dressing and trying to look pretty for each other, handsome for each other. And I'm not saying that they have to be thin or athletic. I'm just saying people notice and they say it's important that they know their partner makes an effort for them. So these things that you would do if you were just meeting somebody, some of them have to be reintroduced or maintained. And you'd be surprised if you just started holding hands or call up your partner in the middle of the day, say, I was just thinking about you and how much I love you. Or saying, let's make a picnic in the floor. It's a crummy day out. Let's pretend it's a nice day. Have a glass of wine and pretend it's a special sunny day. I mean, anything where your partner says, wow, they're really focusing on me. They want to connect to me. That can melt a lot of ice.
Well, I think bottom line, it's saying, you know, you're in this long relationship. It's just not taking it for granted.
You know, spice it up. It's so easy to do.
And I know that in with my wonderful husband, he does the sweetest things just by things like he knows I'm leaving very early in the morning to get to the studio. It's freezing cold. He warms up the car for me. I don't even know it. You know, just little things that are like, ah, oh, cool. That's a great guy.
He is a great guy.
I got to keep him.
Yeah. But tell him, you know, I come home early tonight. We're going to do something special.
Right, but don't you think it has to be mutual, though? It can't just be one person trying to spice it up. The other person has to pitch in there.
No, it has to be, but set the stage. You know, we pay set designers hundreds of thousands of dollars for Broadway plays to put up, you know, a backdrop that we believe in, that helps us, you know, be in the action and believe in the story. And we have to do that for each other, not just turning over at 11 p.m. and saying, you know, you want to do it. If you make it ordinary, it'll be ordinary. If you take time to say, you know, let's pretend this is the first time, or let's have a couple glasses of champagne tonight and turn on an erotic movie. I mean, those kinds of things help the other person get past their own lack of focus on you. I'm not against therapy if there's not enough goodwill going on in the relationship. I think that's a good thing to do. But if there is goodwill, I believe these little things, one of the big findings of the book is how the little things actually have a huge impact.
Pepper, what about the old adage, opposites attract? Did you find the couples who were opposites were happier than those that were similar?
No, we didn't. In the normal bar, we actually found that similarity helped. But it was interesting that there were some things that didn't matter. Political differences didn't matter. Religious differences didn't matter. Values and goals did. People, I think, have an easier time of it if they look at the world pretty much from the same page.
What is one thing that you found in a relationship that men and women both value the most?
Communication.
Really?
It was the number one thing people wanted more of. It was the number one thing people felt was the major help to their relationship. Over sex, over affection, communication, the ability to talk about things, the ability to be heard, the ability to be listened to, the ability to say what's on your mind. That was what both men and women put first.
And so would that be saying, let's just take a time every day to do that? Or
a date night, maybe?
Oh, that's why I think date nights are so important, because you talk about things you care about, not just things you're doing, not just, you know, oh my gosh, we've got to fill out the tax forms, or, you know, we haven't talked to your mother, or stuff like that. I mean, when you go on a date night, you know, you go see a movie, you see a film, you have dinner before or after, you talk about things, you get softer with each other. You can talk about, you know, how you're feeling, what's the future, you know, what's bothering you, what would you love to do, your fantasies about the future. Take a happy topic, like, let's plan something great. I mean, you need time to talk. You need time to remember how you fell in love.
Oh, I love that. That is a great takeaway. Sociologist Pepper Schwartz, co-author of The Normal Bar, this has really been enlightening, and Barbara and I have a lot of homework to do.
Good.
Up next, secrets to recruiting volunteers and keeping them happy. Stay with us.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Do you volunteer or run a nonprofit that needs more volunteers? Are you raising money for your favorite cause? Or have you suddenly, out of love or pure insanity, signed on to spearhead a major fundraiser and have no idea where to begin? Been there, done that.
Well, our guest today, Char McBee, has never received leadership training when she was suddenly put in charge of supervising 500 volunteers. It was hard until a mentor taught her a secret that made it easy to get people to say yes. Since then, she's written two best-selling books, To Lead is to Serve and Joy of Leadership. Char speaks at live events all over the world and writes about fundraising for the Huffington Post. She joins us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Great to have you with us, Char.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You are actually a modern-day Wonder Woman, Char. You've done everything from digging wells in a village in India to managing the largest voter registration drive in California history. Not too shabby. Were you absolutely overwhelmed being in charge of all these volunteers? Like, how do you even do that?
When I first found myself in that situation, I was. I used to lie awake at night thinking, gosh, this is so hard. I'm just trying to do good here. They say if you do something good, people will shoot you down. You know, so people criticize me. They didn't show up. They'd say they'd do something, they wouldn't do it. And even gossiped about me sometimes. It was painful.
And so what did you learn from that experience? How did you overcome all that?
Yeah, it was really hard. And I had this wonderful mentor who just taught me this little secret that changed everything.
Well, you got to tell us.
Okay, here's what she taught me. When it was so painful and I was suffering so much, it was because I was trying to get people to do things, get them to show up, get them to participate, get them to donate, get them to volunteer, get them to take on leadership roles. And she said, how do you feel when someone's trying to get something from you? Do you know how you just like put up all your defenses? She said, you have to make this little shift from getting to giving. Instead of trying to get people to do things, what can you give? She said, our job is not to get people to do things. Our job is to make it possible for people to give as much as their hearts can give.
So you turn it around.
You make this shift. And it changed everything for me. Everything. I mean, then it became easy to get people to participate, to donate, to take on. You can't believe how easy it can be. If you approach people with the idea of, here's what's in it for you.
I'm going to give you this opportunity.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you know? And you share the greatness of your own experience. I mean, that's the other thing. So many volunteer leaders, they do this job because it warms their heart and they feel great. But then they're afraid to ask people. They think when they offer it to someone else, they're offering work as opposed to this wonderful opportunity.
Chance. Yeah.
And I had it work in like this fantastic way with Felicia Rashad. Should I tell you that?
Oh, we'd love that story.
Yeah.
And we all remember who Felicia is. She was the...
The Cosby.
Yeah.
Mrs. Bill Cosby on the Cosby Show.
Well, I saw this work with her that was so interesting. While I was writing my first book, To Lead is to Serve, I was working for her, helping her with her PR. And she was performing in Las Vegas at the Las Vegas Hilton. Not like we know her as Mrs. Cosby, but more like Diana Ross. Costume changes and backup singers. And it was like this fantastic show. And I saw it one night. And the next day, Felicia and I were sitting around the pool at the Las Vegas Hilton. I just mentioned that I was writing a book called To Lead is to Serve. And she said, to lead is to serve. That's true, isn't it? And that was like the whole conversation. And I said, yes. And then that night I went and saw her show again. And something magical happened in there. The audience just wanted to dance on stage with her. And she poured her heart out over all these people. And they gave her a standing ovation. I went backstage afterwards and said, what happened out there tonight? I mean, last night the show was great, but tonight, magic. And she said, I just kept thinking, how could I serve my audience?
Oh, I hope you got a commission for that one.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
So it's just that little shift. I have to ask you how to apply that, because I have signed on a board of quite a few times and been at the helm of fundraisers.
Because you have a big heart.
Oh, I'm a sucker. I'm the one that shows
up. She can't say no.
And nobody else shows up at the meeting. That's what I learned. Oh. And then you're put in charge. But besides that, it is difficult to quote unquote get volunteers to sign on board. So how do you approach people to volunteer? You know, say there's this massive fundraiser and you need 500 people.
Yeah.
What is the trick? What do you do? How do you appeal?
They have this saying in fundraising that if you ask for money, they give you advice. If you ask for advice, they give you money.
Oh, I like that one.
And I had this experience when I was organizing this big thing in Hawaii, and I had a list as long as my arm of things to do, and I saw this man coming in, this big Hawaiian man, and I thought, oh no, he's going to want to sit around and talk, and I don't have time for this. But magically, I let him talk. He came in, he sat down, he told me how much he loved this organization, etc. I listened to him. At the end of it, he said, well, what are you doing? And one of the things that I was trying to do was get an article in the paper. And I'd been working for weeks on trying to get this article. And he said, oh, you want an article in the paper? He picks up the phone. He calls the publisher of the newspaper. He and I go down to the publisher's office. I tell him my story. The publisher said, that sounds great. What do you want? I said, I want an article to come out before the event so people can come. We got a full page article.
Wow.
My secret is, like, listen to people. Do you know, I spent 3 weeks trying to get that article. And when I just listened to this man, he got it for me in
a
second.
You gave him something so precious. You gave him your time.
Yeah.
You are listening to the Two Boomer Babes. Our guest is Shar McBee, the author of the books To Lead Is to Serve and Joy of Leadership. More with Shar when we return. This episode of Two Boomer Babes is sponsored by OnePriceTaxes.com.
Life is full of surprises. Filing your taxes shouldn't be.
OnePriceTaxes has been making online taxes easy, accurate, and affordable since 2007.
States' returns are included for free. And unlike other filing sites, there are no hidden fees
guaranteed. Welcome back. This is Barb and Kathy, the Two Boomer Babes. We're speaking with leadership expert Shar McBee. Shar, you were talking about how there needs to be sort of a mind shift about getting volunteers and really luring them. What would be an attractive flyer or e-blast for attracting volunteers?
You want your subject line not to be boring, like volunteers needed. You need something like, we're having a great party Saturday night, want to join us. Something that would make people be interested in it.
And then how important is social media in this whole thing? I mean, do you use
Facebook
and Twitter and tweeting and all that stuff?
I can't tell you how many organizations I've seen who thought because the economy was so bad, they couldn't really afford to have their big fundraiser. And so they just sort of did a silent auction on Facebook and ended up making more money than they've ever made in the history of the organization. Oh, I think it's important. So the thing is, if you make people feel included, they'll support you. And when people feel excluded, they'll actually undermine you.
What is a realistic time commitment that we can ask of people?
I think it has to do with the degree of their enthusiasm for your project. My thing is, I like the idea of ask for a seed. So if you just ask for a seed, or the other way, give a seed. If you just, as a volunteer yourself, I'll give you a seed of my time and then see if it takes root and grows.
And then you also want them to have control over their time, I would assume. I mean, that's one of the big reasons you volunteer.
I mean, we've all seen volunteer leaders who are like Nazis, you know. To lead is to serve. It means you too. That's the thing that's hard to get. When people have big hearts, they give too much. So my advice is you know, give a seed. You know, if you're so burnt out and stressed, who can you serve? So you
exactly.
have to think of, when you think of like to lead us to serve, if you're serving your organization, you have to also serve yourself. Does this pay to kill yourself? No.
Char, you were saying that fundraising is so tough. That's my big thing. I just cannot stand to ask people for money, no matter how great the organization or cause is. So do you have any advice for us?
I do. My advice for you is, what have you received from giving? And then you offer that. You, like, if you've gotten a good feeling, or you feel connected to the community, or you feel warm all over when you see a child walk with braces that you paid for, you give what you've received. And it works magically. If you're trying to get somebody's money, nobody's looking for ways to give away their money.
Right.
But everybody's looking for that great feeling you get, for a feeling of connectedness, making new friends.
Or making a difference in someone's
life.
Or show them the results of your money that you're getting as well.
Exactly.
What are some other ways to inspire people to really serve alongside of us?
there was this lady once. I was in Austin, Texas, organizing this event, and this lady was so stressed out. And she came over and she said to me, "I just can't get any support." She was the chair of this event. I said, "Oh, if you're looking for support, your greatest support is gratitude." I heard that once, and I never could get it. Like, how can gratitude, which is so ephemeral, be something as solid as support? But if you look at it, you will see. So what happened with this woman is we both made a list of five people in the organization that we were grateful to. We got on the phone, we called these five people, and we left messages what we were grateful to that person for. At the end of those five phone calls, she was so energized and excited. And she went back, and a month later, the event was a success. And she said to me, "That was the turning point. When she stopped trying to get people to support her and started giving her gratitude, everything changed for her."
Oh, I can understand that. Char, one of your books is called The Joy of Leadership. Why is it The Joy of Leadership?
Because everybody in nonprofits doesn't want to step up and take chair, you know, because they think, "Oh, it's so hard." And, you know, and I think it can be so much fun. It can be one of your most learning, energizing, exciting things. If you're doing it from the idea of offering people opportunities to participate. So I wrote that book to make it easier for people to say yes to take on leadership roles in nonprofits.
Well, leadership and volunteer expert Char McBee, thanks so much for offering some incredible advice. And we're going to head out and sign up, right, Barbara?
Absolutely.
Well, I'm going to recruit you.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
We boomers are of that certain age where body parts may be sagging, drooping, and basically wrinkling up. And those are some of the nicer adjectives.
Yeah, I mean, trying to keep up in the looks department sometimes feels like swimming against the tide.
Growing older gracefully is certainly the goal, but what if we need a bit of help, externally that is? It's not unusual these days for us boomers to seek out a plastic surgeon.
So joining us on the phone to talk about the latest in cosmetic surgery is Dr. Robert Siegel. He's a plastic surgeon at the Austin Weston Center for Cosmetic Surgery in Northern Virginia. Welcome to the program, Dr. Siegel.
Well, thank you, ladies. Nice to be with you.
Let's first talk about procedures for our face, because I guess that's what people look at first. And, you know, we don't want to look 20 when we're 50. Okay, 56. But we want to look fresh and youthful. And we don't want to necessarily go the surgical route, at least not yet. So what are our options?
You start with prevention. Who knew back in the 70s that we weren't supposed to lather baby oil on the sun on ourselves while we're bathing at the beach?
But with a reflector,
right? The reflector and the iodine, right? And we did that, and we shouldn't have, because there's not a lot worse than sun for your skin. Sugar might come in as a second, close second, but if you haven't done the sun damage thing, you know, don't start now. Use sunscreen whenever you go outside as much as you can, especially on your face. It'll take it to extremes, but, you know, you wear some sunscreen. It's a good idea. It'll prevent a lot of the sun damage that shows up as early wrinkling. But let's say you've already got some of that stuff. And what you end up noticing is that as we get older, certain things sort of go in an order. As we enter our late 30s, the area under the eye, the cheek, sort of develops a hollow or a dark circle, maybe. And then as we get into our 40s, maybe we start to get a jowl along the jawline, and more wrinkles start to show up in our forehead. And then we get in our 50s, and the neck starts to show some aging as well. And
this is so depressing.
It is.
I'm going to cheer you
downer.
Up in a minute, though. I'm going to cheer you up. So I think what you can do is like you can forestall a lot of this stuff You know, you can forestall the wrinkling by sunscreen early. You can forestall some of the drooping by some of the littler things that we can do, injections like Botox and neuromodulators, or some of these fillers that we have now that are really so wonderful. And I think we can put off some of these surgical procedures that become necessary until we get into our late 50s and 60s. That's the good news, that we're getting better at that sort of thing. We also have lasers now that are far less invasive, and you're back to work, you know, almost the next day. You know, maybe you do it on a Friday, you're back to work on a Monday. Those sorts of things add up to very powerful treatments to keep us, you know, looking our best, you know, well into our 50s and 60s. People are working longer into their careers. They're having children later. It's important to look and feel your best. So
yeah, we want to look good. I have to ask you, because my dermatologist says Renova is a wonder cream. What do you think about that?
Anything that involves Retin-A is a wonder cream, and Renova is one of those in that category, okay? So what is Retin-A? Retin-A is a vitamin analog of vitamin A that has been used on the face forever. I mean, for 30 years, something like that. Initially, when you start with Retin-A, you'll find that your skin gets kind of irritated by it, and then you build up a tolerance to it, and that itching, redness, flakiness that you sort of show up with early on in the treatment with Retin-A sort of goes away. Renova was developed probably about 15 years ago to combine a moisturizer with the Retin-A to try to make that initial period of irritation sort of less than, you know, to sort of make it a little bit easier to adapt to the Retin-A that you're taking. And to a large degree, it works. But anything with Retin-A in it is really a pretty good idea.
Now, what about the laser? How effective is that for wrinkle removal?
Lasers. Think of lasers as a hose of light, right? Like you're spraying light. That's all a laser is. A laser is a single wavelength of light. And depending on what generates that wavelength of light, well, it's gonna land on a certain what we call chromophore, or a thing that's going to absorb the light. Now, the thing that we use to get rid of wrinkles is a light wavelength that is absorbed by water. And every cell in our body has water in it. So if you spray a hose of light on your face, you can attack all of the cells on the surface of the face. Fine. Now, the problem is that some of these lasers are very strong. Some of them are very weak. And the stronger ones are going to really resurface the skin. They're going to take off a layer of skin that's going to take a fair amount of time to recover from, a couple of weeks maybe. And you can even get a little bit too deep sometimes. And I don't know if you've ever seen this on anybody, but sometimes you'll get to the level in the skin where the cells that make the pigment live, and people can get a little white even from lasers if they're too strong. So what's new in the universe of plastic surgery along these lines? Well, we've taken that hose of light and put a specialized nozzle on it that takes the spray and converts it to little tiny drill holes. These drill holes you can control. You can control the depth of them, you can control the width of them, and you can control the spacing of them. And generally what happens is we only hit 20% of the skin now at any given time with this fractionated laser, or Fraxel is one of the brand names. And what you're doing when you hit only a small percentage of the skin is you're allowing that 80% that hasn't been hit to resurface and cover the skin where the 20% was hit. And you end up with very little redness. You end up with some swelling, but very little redness. And you're able to recover from this in just a very short amount of time, a couple of days, not weeks. It's a very safe procedure. You can do it not only on your face, but you can do it on your neck and on the area that's called the décolletage, the area that you show with a shirt, an open shirt. You can do it on your hands.
And how long does it last?
There's a couple of different wavelengths. Sometimes you have to come back and repeat this a few times to really get, you know, the best result that's going to last for years and years and years. There's another wavelength at 1927 that's relatively new that you can just do one time, and that will handle a lot of the brown sun damage, not the wrinkling per se, but those brown sunspots, you know, that you get on the tops of your hands sometimes, or on your face, or even on your neck and chest. So that's a one-time deal. And that'll last forever. And then what you do is you set the clock back. Now you go back to the prevention thing with sunscreen. And now you're back in your 30s.
We're talking about cosmetic procedures, surgical and non-surgical, on the Two Boomer Babes Radio Hour. Our guest is Dr. Robert Siegel, a plastic surgeon with the Austin Weston Center for Plastic Surgery in Northern Virginia. We've been talking about the non-surgical procedures. Let's go on to the surgical route. So when do we know when it's time to go the surgical route? We don't want it to look obvious, But we don't want to be scary either. So at what point do you decide to go get surgery?
If you look in the mirror and you pull your face back, you lift your eyebrows up, you tighten up your cheek with your hands, every day, you're right to come talk to me. If you do that less than once a week, don't do it. Some people are kind of in the middle. They do it a few times a week. They sit there in front of the mirror when they're getting dressed up or something, and they're paralyzed by it. Their evening is ruined. They're thinking about how they're going to look. And in those instances where it's happening a few times a week, it depends how debilitating it is. But it's worth it if you're thinking about it a few times to every time a week, every day, to come and talk to a cosmetic surgeon about it. Not even find a cosmetic surgeon. The best place to start is with your friends. Believe it or not. I mean, if somebody's had cosmetic surgery that you know, ask them. The odds are they'd be thrilled to tell you. You know, they want to talk
Siegel,
about it.
What do you say? Hey, your face looks great. Where did you get the work done?
Well, yeah. I mean, what better compliment can you pay the person, you know? Sure. So that's a great place to start. If you're lost there and you don't really know anybody that's had any cosmetic surgery done, well, there's a couple of websites that are good, and I'm a member of the American Board of Plastic Surgeons, and we have a website, plasticsurgery.org, that lists all the plastic surgeons that are board certified in your area. But I would say to the prospective patient out there that not every board certified plastic surgeon really specializes, loves, does a lot of cosmetic surgery. And so there are many surgeons out there that aren't plastic surgeons, board-certified plastic surgeons, that are very good at cosmetic surgery. They're ENT surgeons or dermatologists. Certainly you can start with that website, plasticsurgery.org, but then go in and interview the surgeon. And I'll tell you a trick. When you go to that surgeon's office, look at his staff, because the odds are he's operating on his staff, all right? And if the staff doesn't look the way you want to look, I think you maybe go find somebody else.
Hey, do you have a job opening in your office?
I think you guys are doing great with what you're doing.
We'll sweep your floors, Rob.
We could
come in and do anything.
I love it.
I'm curious about our boomer dudes.
Yeah.
So how many men do you have coming in to sort of seeking your services?
All right, I'm going to tell you a dirty little secret about life, okay, that I've learned from my little perch here at the Austin Weston Center. The answer to your question is about 10% of my practice is men. And that has remained consistent throughout my practice here for the last 20 years. And here's the secret, and it's not pretty, but as men get older, they get more power in the world. They get more prestige, they get more money. And sadly, that is the opposite for women. Women in this country, in this day and age, get less power as they get older. A lot of their power is tied to the younger, as they're younger, and their looks and their beauty. And that's why I think, 90% of my rejuvenation is in women. Plus, I think women are braver. They're used to doing things with their faces and hair, et cetera, that men aren't used to. But there's a certain misfit, if you will, between how you feel and how you're treated in the world for women that doesn't show up for men. And so that's one of the reasons I think that men don't make up a more significant portion of my practice.
Well, finally, Rob, we only have about a minute left, but I have to ask you. You know, I can see how plastic surgery can become really addictive. I mean, we were talking before, it's like redoing one room and the rest of your house looks really old and shabby. Yeah. And, you see some really scary looking people that have had way too much plastic surgery. So how does one avoid that slippery slope?
That is such a great question, and there is no great answer to that. What you ultimately need is a surgeon who has his heart in the right place, who doesn't need the money, who is going to put the brake on when it needs to be applied. You look at Michael Jackson, that kind of a situation, and it's so easy for, a plastic surgeon to be swayed by somebody into doing things. And you just have to, as a plastic surgeon, just put your foot down and say, listen, too much. We have to stop.
Plastic surgeon Dr. Robert Siegel, thanks so much for the primer on what's
ladies.
In these days when it comes to cosmetic surgery.
Thanks.
Okay, and Rob, we want a little consult after the show, okay?
You know where to find me.
Okay. Up next, worried about getting sick on your next adventure? Stay with us. Find out about some must-have spices to pack in your suitcase.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general. It was just announced that the vast majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far, but our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, and son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save...
your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of...
your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate... mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Nothing can spoil a vacation adventure like getting sick, especially in an exotic locale. It can be very difficult to find a pharmacy or even a doctor. Now there's an alternative, using spices for medicinal purposes. Ethne and Philippe de Vienne, a.k.a. the Spice Trekkers, travel the world in search of good quality spices. They join us on the phone from Montreal to shoot the breeze with the babes. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We understand that when you both travel, you always carry three spices with you just in case. And the first is ginger. So, Philippe, besides tasting really good, what does ginger do?
Ginger is really good for all sorts of stomach ailments. When you travel, that's the main complaint is stomach ailments.
How do you ingest it?
Well, you could just chew a little piece of ginger or make a tea.
Because when you're that sick, you don't care. If anything has the potential to make you better, you know, you'll chew into whatever, right?
Yeah.
It couldn't be worse than what you're going through already.
Yeah, because what we bring, of course, is dry ginger, which keeps forever, in a little jar, and we buy whole chunks of ginger. So they stay fresh, and all the medicinal value is all there in a big piece.
Philippe, what about anise, which you call the big kahuna in your travel kit? What on earth would you use that for?
Anise is the ultimate medication for traveler's diarrhea. It is quite literally you're lying on the ground wishing you were not alive, and you chew a tablespoon of that because at that point you don't even have time to make a tea, and you just chew it, and 5 minutes later you're just looking for the next barbecue.
I mean, there's a distinction, I think, that we have to make, because sometimes you just have, you have some stomach pains or you have some cramps. If it's not preventing you from leaving your hotel room, then you can get on with the business of cup of ginger tea or something like that. But if there's something that is really made you totally immobile, and we're talking about diarrhea, people, let's call it what it is, that's where the aniseed comes in.
And it just gives you total relief for about an hour. It doesn't cure the diarrhea. It just relieves the symptom and stops the diarrhea. And then you just, an hour later, you just take more. And that's it. It's, I mean, it's a spice. You can take as much as you want. There's no limit on the dosage for anise.
Well, the third spice is turmeric, which you fondly call the wonder drug of the spice world. So, Ethne, we hear you've had some personal experience with the healing properties of this spice. So
absolutely.
I
the most dramatic was a root canal procedure that I had. It was terribly painful, of course, and the dentist immediately recommended antibiotics and painkillers, knowing what I was going to be going through. I filled a prescription, and I thought, but before I go that route, let me see if my turmeric approach wouldn't be better. And I simply took some ground turmeric, put it on the wound, and the pain stopped immediately. The swelling went down immediately, and when my dentist called me a couple of hours later to find out how I was doing, because it was so dramatic, the procedure, I said, I'm fine, I have no pain, I'm not, you know, going to be taking any of the prescriptions that I filled at my own expense, because I don't need to.
Because turmeric is a great antiseptic. You clean a cut with some soap and water, and when the cut kind of dries up, you rub some turmeric and you put a covering on it. And that's all you need, because it's not only is it antiseptic, it's also anti-inflammatory, so it shrinks your wounds, it dries them up, and it makes them heal faster than any medication that I know of.
But let's not forget that when all of that is said and done, there is another essential that we always carry with us, because that really heals psychological trauma as well as physical trauma.
Oh, please do tell.
Scotch.
Oh, that works with everything, doesn't it?
Sure it does.
So do you mix the spices with the scotch?
Nah.
Wouldn't want to waste either one on the other.
Well, Ethne and Philippe de Vienne of SpiceTruckers.com, this has been very informative and great fun. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's been nice chatting with you both.
This episode of Two Boomer Babes is sponsored by OnePriceTaxes.com.
Life is full of surprises. Filing your taxes shouldn't be.
OnePriceTaxes has been making online taxes easy, accurate, and affordable since 2007.
States' returns are included for free, and unlike other filing sites, there are no hidden fees
guaranteed.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
We've experienced some pretty crazy weather over the past few years, with paralyzing snowstorms in the Deep South, tornadoes in January, and record-breaking dry conditions in the West. Are we just going through one of those natural weather cycles, or is it something more?
Joining us to provide some perspective is Robert Lautzenheiser, who began working for the Weather Bureau in 1940 and rose through the ranks to become the state climatologist for northern and central New England. Now 98 years old, Bob continues to take his own official weather observations from his home in Reading, Massachusetts. We're delighted to have him on the phone with us, and welcome to the show, Bob.
Thank you.
Well, you've observed and recorded the weather for almost 75 years, so basically you've seen it all weather-wise. What's your take on why we are having such wild and crazy weather, especially this winter?
I have seen many violent storms in past years, some long ago. But it does seem true that they have become more frequent. No single storm can prove the case that global warming is a cause, but it does seem most likely that global warming is a culprit. The increase in CO2 and other gases from human activities has certainly caused warming, not only shown in recorded temperatures, but by the disappearing glaciers. increased warmth could very reasonably be expected to ramp up weather systems and the strength of the systems and frequencies.
So do you think this weather is going to continue in the spring and the summer? We're going to have these really bad storms?
You never know for sure, but could be.
Now, Bob, one of your duties when you were the state climatologist in New England was to report about storms. Can you tell us about the biggest storm you wrote about?
Well, that might be the blizzard of 78. That's 1978, 26 years ago. By over 27 inches of snow, traffic came to a complete halt. In fact, the state declared a ban on driving statewide for several days. And though it should not have applied to Cape Cod, where conditions weren't so bad.
Yeah, so you're talking about the East Coast.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it was pretty much statewide in Massachusetts and much of New England, actually.
Huh. Well, Bob, when you first started working for the Weather Bureau back in 1940, what kind of instruments were they using to forecast the weather? I mean, did they have radar back then?
No, I didn't have radar. Forecasting was thought to be an art or a seat of the pants expertise. But yet a great many instruments were available. A vast network of surface observation stations connected by teletype covered the continent, and these included balloon ascents tracked by telescope, which produced good charts of the winds aloft, and also a large number of upper air stations were released huge balloons carrying instruments with radio transmitters. So the forecasters then were not without instruments, but they still had to put a lot of interpretation into what they saw. They did do a pretty good job. But radar then was in its infancy, very infancy, primarily being developed before war use. After the war, they were seen to be a benefit for weather, becoming of very great importance.
Bob, what do you think is the single most important innovation in weather forecasting?
I think that's an easy one, Barbara. It's the development of numerical forecasting and the computer. Now, the European model computer system is said to give usable forecasts up to 4 days ahead, and the U.S. system only about 3 days ahead. Most of the people use the European model instead of our own, or they look at both of them, and if they both agree, that's great.
And, Bob, let me ask you really quickly. In the last several decades, we noticed that fewer people have been getting their weather information directly from the National Weather Service, and they're using more, you know, other entities like AccuWeather and the Weather Channel. How do you feel about weather becoming such a big business these days?
Well, the first weather, private weather organizations used to just cater to particular industries who needed special work and what the Weather Service wasn't able to provide. Now, it seems to be that people get everything from the TV, and they hear this, he or she give the weather, and they think it's coming direct from those people's mouths. And actually, it's still coming pretty much from the Weather Service. Where do these people get their data? They get it from the Weather Service. And the Weather Service still operates the fast observational networks, and they operate the computers, and without it, those people would be lost.
Well, climatologist Robert Lotzenheiser, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and experience with the two Boomer Babes.
It's been a pleasure.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes twoboomerbabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zyma Communications.